everybody. Welcome back to the Marvel Bronze Age. I'm Ed.
And he's Ed. Wait, that's not how that goes. I'm Levi.
No. Right, yeah, I took care of mine.
Okay, sorry.
You need to throw out yours.
Sorry.
And we talk about the gist of the podcast is, well, runs pretty closely to what the title of the show is.
We worked hard to get a title that would help lead people.
Welcome to our movie review show.
Right.
Yes. Now, Bronze Age.
Romancing the Stone. How'd you like that one?
There you go. I give it a thumbs up.
Me too. Two strong thumbs up. And that's our show, folks. Good night.
That'd be fun. That's almost like a Twitter movie review.
Exactly.
I can review that in 140 words or less.
140 characters, but yeah.
Characters on Twitter, yeah. Marvel Bronze Age, guys, that's roughly 1970 to roughly 1986 is where we're looking. Marvel books, superhero, we're trying to avoid as best we can any of the romance and humor books that are coming out.
Yeah, because romance and humor has no business in comic books.
I agree wholeheartedly. I don't care if my superheroes ever have a romance.
Mm-hmm.
Westerns and war books we will probably cover as they come up. As a matter of fact, one of our two books selected for tonight is a war book.
It is, and was dedicated to the heroes of the Navy.
Yes, it's a poor knockoff of another Marvel book, which I suspect is a knockoff of a DC book. But I don't know exactly when they came out to know which came first.
Well, that's a lot of knockoffs. It's like the mob up in here.
We've read one of Nick Fury's books, mm-hmm. and this Captain Savage is just like, oh man.
Well, yeah. I mean, I definitely noticed, but I don't know.
I suspect that that Nick Fury is a knockoff of Sergeant Rock.
Is that over at DC? DC, okay. I don't think I've ever read that one.
Yeah, Sergeant Rock, Easy Company is his group.
Oh, okay. Now, I have heard of it, but I still don't think that I've actually read the comic.
Yeah, I've read it on and off, but not, you know, enough to know enough about it to say which came first or anything like that. Could be, like so many other comic book ideas, that they both truly just came out about the same time anyways.
Mm-hmm.
But this Captain Savage that we're going to talk about, it definitely is a knockoff of Nick Fury and his Howling Commandos.
Yeah.
Which, that's one of the books, Captain Savage, guys, issue 19. The other book is Captain America, issue 123. It's a Captain America book. We'll talk more about it when we get there. But
it was very Captain-y.
Yes, yes. First off, let's see what we think about this Captain Savage title here.
All right, let's do it.
Captain Savage and his Battlefield Raiders is what it says on the cover. Let me look on the indicia. The indicia just says Captain Savage. So that is usually what I take as the official title of the book, is whatever the indicia says. If that's how you pronounce that word, I-N-D-I-C-I-A. Indicia, whatever.
It depends on whether you're from the north or the south.
Ah, okay. I'm from neither.
You're in the middle.
Yes.
You are the northernmost southern and the southernmost northern.
That's it. I'm Swiss, yes. I claim no side.
There you go.
The cover is a split cover. We have... The tail inside is a Submariner's tail, so the right side, well, not so, but the right side of the cover is a scene inside a submarine with a narrated caption, "They serve in silence." And on the left side of the book, we see a destroyer on the surface dropping a, I'm throwing air quotes here, trash can trying to hit the submarine that's at the bottom of the front cover resting on the bottom of this section of ocean with a speaking caption that says, "Brace yourselves, swabbies, that depth charge is gonna," and then that's where it switches over. You would read it, "They serve in silence."
So. Dun, dun, dun.
Interesting whole opening and feel to this book. I believe I remember in volume one of the Marvel Bronze Age reading the issue before this.
Oh, I thought so too.
Yeah, not Doc Savage. That's an entirely different character.
Yes, it is.
Captain Savage getting the news that he's lamenting mm-hmm. about this issue. I remember reading that. So
yeah, didn't it come in like a letter form, and they were like on an island or something doing a mission?
Yeah, that's what I thought. It didn't happen in a very cool way at all,
no.
I didn't think.
No.
We do find out from the beginning of this issue that we are at the end of 1942, ringing in the beginning of 1943. So we actually have some references to when this is taking place.
All right. Now, before we get to the comic, there's actually one big thing that I noticed. Well, not before we get to the comic. Before we get to the body of the comic, there's something that I noticed. On the inside, there's a new strongman model.
On the inside, there's a new what?
A new strongman model. You know how Arnold Schwarzenegger has been holding up the two girls in just about every inside cover?
You're right.
This guy is new. I don't know who he is, but as soon as I flipped to that page, I was like, wait, that's not Arnold.
I wonder if this is a different company also, is why.
Okay.
He reminds me vaguely of somebody, but
Dolph Lundgren?
It's not. No. No, it's not coming to me. It seems like he's reminiscent of a late 70s TV actor is who's coming to mind, but I can't get any better resolution on my brain picture than that, so I'm not sure who that would be. But yeah, just off the top of my head, no, I don't recognize who that is either.
Yeah, but
he's not Arnold.
No.
Yeah, like you said.
No, and that was a bit, you know, you get used to seeing Arnold on the inside cover, and then you open this one, it's like, wait, what?
Yeah.
That's not
no
Arnold.
Doubt. I guess the relationship between Marvel and Arnold must have soured.
I don't know. I just hope he'll be back. Yep.
Yeah, you never know.
Yep. All right, so.
He's probably still out in that jungle covered in mud hiding in the riverbank.
He probably is.
Wait. No, that wasn't Arnold, was it? That was Sylvester Stallone, my bad.
Depending on the movie.
Well, no, I guess he did do that in Predator. Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's true. Covered himself in mud to dampen his heat signature because he realized that's how the dude was tracking him.
Yep.
Speaking of which, last weekend I watched Aliens vs. Predator Requiem.
Is that the one in the town?
Yeah, that they nuke at the end of the movie.
Yeah, with the little alien babies in the public pool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was an interesting movie.
They nuked the town,
yes,
man.
Yes, they did. Yes, they did.
Oh, and the chopper didn't even get far enough out to avoid the EMP,
mm-hmm.
but yet there was a team almost there waiting for them.
Yep.
So that means they had their team in range of the blast.
Yep.
I didn't think that was too cool either. But yeah, nuked a daggone town in Colorado.
I don't remember where it was supposed to have taken place.
Yeah, I think it was Colorado.
It was just such a weird movie.
Hey, yes, it was. We're at here in the comic, we're at a New Year's Eve party, bringing in the new year with the, what are they called again? The Battlefield Raiders. Because Captain Savage is not with them. We don't find out immediately, but pretty quickly we do, that his group is in one place and he is somewhere else. Later on in the book, we do see that his group has apparently been ringing in the new year in Australia.
Yeah, that was a little weird.
I have no idea why they're in Australia. I don't think they're based in Australia.
Maybe that's just where Shore Leave happened to be.
Maybe, because in the last issue they were in some South Pacific island, and so Australia was the nearest point or something. I don't know, but... yeah, a little bit of playing around with the guys here. Apparently there was a bet as to, well, not a bet, but they drew straws as to who got to play the baby New Year. Yeah, and wear the costume and all. And
yeah,
the dude that is now in charge of the group while Savage is away lost. Yeah. So he had to come out, even though he's the highest ranking officer.
Yeah, he's the Sarge.
Yeah, he came out dressed in a diaper with his bush hat on, wearing it all wrong, and shoes and calf socks.
Yes, sir.
With a banner that said 1943. Yeah. That's the only way you could tell he was the baby new. No, I'm kidding. he definitely had something going on. But the guys were messing with him, and, you know, the old He-Man-ish playing around, how cute he looks, and he's going to give them extra KP if they don't, what's he say?
He doesn't want a word of it leaving that room.
Outside, yeah, nobody outside the room. But there is a each of the men has a female companion, so who's to say the females don't go blabbing?
Wait, do they?
So.
Because Sarge doesn't, and Sailor Boy does.
Yep.
It's only the Native American and the French guy, which, by the way, I thought having the French guy in this team that is supposed to so mimic that other team was a little ironical.
Okay. Yeah, it just seems like the one idea is so popular, let's spin it off into another very, very similar idea.
Exactly. And I was like, wait, you got a Frenchman too? Come on now.
Yeah, so we cut now to Simon Savage, the namesake of the book, Savage. He is lamenting the fact that last issue, his wife Kathy didn't just serve him with papers, but sent a letter saying that she had already divorced him.
Mm-hmm, it's done.
Yeah, so he didn't get papers to then try to do anything. He just got notice it was done. And so this issue, we find him by himself. He's off away from the guys, trying to figure out what he's going to do. He's seriously considering not being military anymore, which I guess he's in a good position in that it's up to him. So he's decided that he's going to try to find something to do to take his mind off of it, but still be regular Army.
No, he's a Marine.
Well, regular military. I mean, he's looking for something to do militarily,
right,
rather than something to do on leave as a civilian, right, to take his mind off it. He tries to stay mission-focused. He puts feelers out for other duties other than his normal raidering with his raider crew. And he gets a call for duty as a submarine captain, which apparently was what he was doing prior to the formation of the group he now leads.
Right.
Not knowing the origins of the group, I would imagine that is possible if they went through and picked the quote-unquote best of the best to form this more commando-ish kind of group.
Right.
Okay, he's a commander in that group.
Mm-hmm.
He could have been a commander somewhere else, a boat commander, a sub commander, right, another small unit commander. So, okay.
And I mean, you know, heck, it could have been him that was like, you know what, we need a team to – you know, and so he's like, we'll pick from and over there and him, and I don't care that he's French.
Right? Yeah, there you go. We've worked with the French before. We're good.
Right. Well, it's World War II, so, I mean, it's like we're all in this together.
Heil Hitler.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, I just watched Monuments Men today.
For the first time?
Yes.
How was it?
It was pretty sedate to me.
Okay. I haven't had a chance to watch it yet, so.
The concept, I like the concept. It's a very interesting concept. The actors, a lot of A-list actors that did, you know, as good a job, I imagine, as could be done with the parts. Mm-hmm. But the story overall just was a little on the flat side to have been a movie about a unit active near the line during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you would, so it wasn't about combat, so I, you know, I can kind of understand it, but they were close to the line in trying to do what they were trying to do, but yet they seemed to get out pretty much unscathed,
right.
And the scathing that was done almost seemed forced. Like they said, well, something's got to happen to somebody, so let's do this.
Okay, yeah, I got you.
Two of the guys originally that they got together died. One,
now see,
okay,
come on. I told you I hadn't seen it yet.
One made sense and one didn't, really. That's all I was going to say. Well, it's not giving anything away. Come on, man. You know somebody has to die. It's a World War II movie.
Well, I know, but, you know, it was like Private First Class Pete. I don't know. I haven't seen the movie yet.
Okay, all right. Clooney didn't do that good, so when he died, I'm sorry.
Dude.
He didn't die.
You're not cool at all.
Okay, so, Savage. Savage gets a hold of a mission here that they want done at his old submarine that he formerly commanded. And the mission is a quiet spying mission. So he's, you know, that's also kind of along the lines of what he's looking for. He doesn't want anything with any kind of hard duty. He wants to be able to kick back a little bit.
He's just wanting to get back to the call of the sea, as put it.
It's exactly what he said. Maybe that'll help him clear his head.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes back to a former command and almost immediately runs afoul of the current commander. First, though, we cut back to Australia where the Raiders are training, trying to sweat out the hangovers from the most recent party. The way this is done, you assume that it's the next day.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he says, you know, just because you was up all – this is the Sarge, of course. He says, just because you was up all night don't mean you shouldn't be able to run all day.
So there we go, trying to sweat it out.
And I can attest from experience, yes, it does mean that you can't run all day.
Because you were up all night.
Yes, it means that exactly, as a matter of fact.
Well, apparently not when you're in the military and you're a hard duty soldier and you party hard too.
Yeah, I guess I was not a soldier. I was just an up all nighter guy. So
nothing really happens on this page. Just a lot of quipping back and forth between the men. We do we hear from? No, we don't even hear from all of them.
No, like Sailor Boy isn't there that I can see.
Yeah, just the Sarge and the Indian fellow.
Which, now, I got to bring it up because when I read it, I was like, what? And then I got to remember when this was written. Sarge called him...
Injun?
I thought it was Redskin. And I no, there it is.
Redskin, yeah.
Yep, Redskin. And I was... It was almost like... It was like mildly shocking because I'm like... He just – oh, wait. Okay. 70s. Gotcha.
Yeah. Written in the early 70s, about the mid-40s.
Exactly. So I was like, oh, okay. I see what they're trying to do. But it just – you know, especially with, you know, other things going on nowadays, I was just like, they just – oh, wait. No. Okay.
Oh, yeah. No, no, no. No, you're not doing that nowadays in a comic book.
No, no, no.
That's for sure. You might could get away with calling the dude Blarney like they did at the beginning.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, Redskin is not going to fly. No. I don't even think they would try that.
No, no. And like I said, especially like currently right now, I don't think that they would. But it's just – it's so funny. It's just so funny reading these comics and seeing, you know, even though they're trying to be period piece, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
It's like not even the movies now would do that necessarily unless it was just for impact.
Right, right. About the only one that consistently does it is the what's his name? He's the dude that directed Django.
Tarantino?
Yeah, Tarantino.
Tarantino has no fear, though.
Well, you know, when he does something, period, he does something, period.
Oh, yeah, he does.
So other than him, though, off the top of my head, I can't think of anybody that really sticks to it. They'll, you know, they'll have the dress and the mannerisms and even the setting, but what comes out of the people's mouth is just still pretty PC for that time period.
Yeah, unless it's the antagonist that you really want to hate, that uses all of the racial slurs because he's the really bad guy.
True, true. Yeah, they're just trying to set up just how hard it is he's going to go down.
Mm-hmm, exactly. But other than that, like the fact that certain words and things were used, unfortunately, across the board by, you know, by a lot of people, not just the worst of the worst, that gets overlooked.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They don't.
So that was.
They don't stay true.
Yeah. So that was why it was just a little shock. You know, it's like he said what?
Yeah, you're just going along, and you're like da 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 redskin da 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 redskin.
Yep, that's exactly. I was like, and they're in the military. Like what?
Yeah. So after that scene, we cut back to Captain, I guess he is now since he's on the submarine, Captain Savage.
I think it's Commander.
Commander Savage, okay. And he's having his discussion with Captain Wilhite, who is the gentleman that got the captaincy of the submarine after Savage left.
Right.
So now Savage is back, not necessarily per his own request per se. I mean, this isn't just his doing. He has been tasked by higher ups to take over the submarine, over Captain Wilhite, command it for this particular mission, and then take off. Wilhite has come in, and Savage, trying to just deflect anything before it happens, tells him, you know, look, I'm just coming on for this one mission. They wanted me to take care of this, and after this, I'm gone. I'm not coming to get rid of you, to take back the submarine, or anything like that. And the reason that Captain Wilhite wanted the conversation is because he feels, in that he has been the one commanding these men, that it would be better for this mission if he gave the commands to the men and Savage relegated himself to more a observer position.
Mm-hmm.
Which Savage just immediately says, no.
Mm-hmm.
And not only does he say no, but he says no, and that's the end of it. Bye-bye.
Pretty much.
So, you know, he just tells him, you know, no, we're not going to tiptoe through stuff. I'm in command. I'm going to be in command. And if you don't like it, you can go back to your room. Shut the door, young man.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, he just tells him he is going to be in command whether Wilhite likes it or not for the duration of this particular mission. And then after Wilhite leaves, Savage kind of hammers the point home in a little soliloquy here. That he finishes up by saying, if I were to give up command of this mission, it might be destroyed. So now not only has he been commanded to oversee this mission, but he feels that if it wasn't for him, the mission probably would not succeed. So,
which is interesting because on the dock he was saying, you know, I'm just here to do a mission. They told me to do it. And then he has this discussion with, you know, the young blood there. And now he's just so totally convinced that, you know, I have to do this. And if I don't, like, you know, it'll fail.
Right. He is the man for the mission.
Yeah. Now.
That's all.
Yeah.
So
before it was just, you know, I'm just glad that they had a position and I can go out and do something.
I'm just looking for something to do.
Yeah.
You know,
and now it's like, now it's like, oh, now I know. Now I know.
After talking to Wilhite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So evidently Wilhite, you know, it just rubbed him all the wrong ways.
I don't know. You know, after the peeing contest and the comparing equipment, mm-hmm. I guess Savage felt emboldened.
Yeah.
And he was like, now I know I'm the man.
Yep.
So Savage goes to bed, or I guess what, hits the rack?
Yes.
Racks or whatever they've got. That's not what they said. But that does bring up an interesting point. At this point, we're about almost halfway through the book, and it hadn't really struck me yet. But here in another three or four pages, I will have come to the conclusion that the amount of forced jargon in the book was just over the top.
Okay.
Just it so much of the lingo that Stan Lee threw in just seemed to have been forced in, and I thought it made the speech kind of halting.
A little bit, yeah, because it's just for people who don't know, no, it's like, what does that mean?
Well, even to me, I mean, I understand a lot of the lingo, maybe not all of it, but it just seemed really forced to try to get as much in as he could to make it feel genuine.
Right, real.
Or,
this is how they really did it.
Yeah, that's just it. After you get done, you're like, wow, that's how they really talk. Maybe. I don't know,
one,
you know.
One of the biggest things I've wondered with the period issues is this just like what the writer or Stan knows, or are they consulting someone, or are they going off of movies? I mean, where are they getting all of these words that you know, I guess basically you've seen in movies?
Well, definitely. I've heard it in movies. I heard it in World War II period TV shows.
Mm-hmm.
I know that Stan Lee avoided, if I recall, any military service. I forget why or how, you know, how he managed to stay out of it. Now, there have been some artists and whatnot that worked for the military. Off the top of my head, and it's not the artist for this book, but a big-name artist, Will Eisner. He was in the military for about a year and a half.
Okay.
Doing what he did outside, though. While he was in, he was doing art for instruction manuals and things like that.
Okay.
Jack King Kirby, I believe, did a stint in the military.
Okay, so then there's a possibility that they had people in-house that maybe knew a little bit?
It's possible. That they, you know, that Stan could actually sit down with somebody there at Marvel Studios and say, you know, hey, Phil, what kind of things would you guys have been sitting around talking about in this situation when you were over in Germany?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's possible, certainly. And, I mean, it's very possible given that in the early 70s like this, you know, we're almost 30 years removed. There had to be people who served that were around the offices doing different things.
Oh, sure.
In New York City,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, so they would have been available, I would think. Now, I have no idea if, you know, anybody was actually asked or anything. I've never heard stories to that extent at all. So
it's just, I wonder, like, how they came. How they got the information.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. And it could be, like you said, something as simple as, well, you know, that's the way they were doing it in the movies.
Right. So they copied that because that would be familiar to everyone.
Right, yeah. So the Savage is awakened by one of his crew members here that is telling him they have reached the destination, original destination of their mission. Now, their mission was to spy on a small Japanese convoy. Although to them it wasn't a Japanese convoy, it was a, pardon me, NIP convoy. And that came earlier on. I neglected to mention the dropping of the word NIP in relation to Japanese. So there's another word very, very similar to your Redskin.
Right.
Word of earlier.
So it's interesting because in another World War II based comic, what was the other one that we did? It's just here recently for this season.
For a word for what?
It was another issue. It was a different team, but that was where I first read NIP, and I was like, what does that mean? And then. Because I'd never heard it.
NIP?
Yeah, I'd never heard that one used for anyone. I thought that was really weird.
It's my understanding it was fairly commonly derogatorily used because of the association with the word Nippon.
Oh, okay.
A shortening of the word Nippon.
Mm-hmm.
Which... Nippon, I believe, isn't that a Japanese word?
I thought it was a location. Maybe I'm wrong then.
NIPPON. I know that's where NIP is from. It's the shortened version of that word. And Nipponese, rather than Japanese, and then shortened to NIP. What NIPPON actually means, if it's English or not, I'm not sure. I didn't look it up, but I am familiar with it from other. Media where they have used, particularly in World War II, or a little bit earlier, maybe on back into like the mid-30s when the Americans and the Japanese were really starting to be exposed to one another.
Right.
NIP and NIPS was a word that Nippon was another name for Japan, says Terry.
Oh, okay.
Nippon or Nihon. So NIPPON must be an older Japanese word.
Mm.
So, okay. So, and then we just shortened it into something derogatory and used it.
Okay.
So they were meant to spy on a small Japanese convoy, get things like where they're heading, number of ships, and then relay that information back to their command. So they're on site where they're supposed to intersect this Japanese convoy, except that their 4 or 5 ship convoy has now ballooned to 40 or 50 ships.
Yep.
So many that without a concerted effort using the periscope, they can't even count how many are there. They would have to take a couple minutes to actually count up that high.
Right. They said that they saw at least 2 carriers. So, you know, if you put together, you know, the fact that if you have a carrier, you have all of these sporting ships.
Right.
That go with that. So you've got a large, large flotilla.
And, I guess in 1943, of course, they wouldn't be alluding to the fleet convoy that was used to attack Hawaii, because that's already happened.
Yeah.
So it's curious, in 40
through 43,
early 43, that there would be a convoy of Japanese ships this big, unless they were, I don't know, going to something maybe in the Pacific that the U.S. was doing somewhere in some of the Pacific Islands, Guam or Midway, although I'm not sure when those are going. But anyways, very big, much bigger than this one submarine was ever supposed to run into.
Yeah, no kidding.
So now they're in a situation where Savage is concerned that because there are so many ships, the chances of being found out, even in the submarine, are greatly increased. So he decides to try to get as much information as they can, which basically is counting the ships, and this doesn't say so here, but more than likely trying to determine what the ships are.
Mm-hmm.
And then, given a certain amount of time, that's all we can stand at periscope depth. We'll drop down as low as we can go, which isn't extremely low in this particular part of the ocean because they can go to very near the seabed.
Yeah.
And we will wait it out until we're sure everything's passed, and then we'll leave to get out of here, because if we try to leave while all of these ships are in the vicinity, something is bound to hear us, and then if they do, they will turn and investigate, and you know, they'll have this whole issue that, first of all, they don't want, you know, in being a submarine, but also it's kind of not what the mission parameters were.
Right.
They were supposed to get in and out without being seen,
mm-hmm.
besides the concerns about being seen.
Right.
So Savage decides to do that, decides to drop down. So they do that. They stay up as long as they can. They drop down. And actually, according to this one panel here, physically rest the submarine on the bottom.
Now, this is something that I found interesting. I don't know anything about the capabilities of submarines, and maybe one of our listeners can send us a comment on whether or not this is actually practice or has ever been practice. But I can't imagine submarine resting on the bottom. I can't imagine that being an acceptable practice, given what they could possibly rest on. And the damage that could do to a ship, even with it just lightly just floating down and gently resting. I can't see that being even an uncommon practice.
No, there's something about that just rings as no. You know, it's just like,
I mean, that would be like beaching a craft.
Yeah, in essence, that's exactly what they would be doing. And you know, to my thinking, if you rested on the bottom, you would have no way of knowing how deep you would sink.
Mm-hmm.
So you're liable to get stuck.
Exactly. Or I mean, what if under the soot and the sand and the, you know, everything else, there's I don't know, like some sharp rocks. I mean, I don't know. I can't imagine that this would be a thing that they do.
Yeah. Now, I could see, you know, using your charts, seeing how deep it is, going as deep as we can, but keeping, you know, 15 meters from the bottom, or you know, something like
that. Right. Exactly.
But yeah, it. This here they actually show one scene kind of shows them perhaps almost suspended mid-column,
mm-hmm.
perhaps with the escaping air. I guess that's meant to signify that they're releasing ballast and are sinking,
right.
Which if they were releasing this much ballast, the ship would have seen them anyways. But okay.
Well, and that was another thought I had. I was like, those are a lot of bubbles.
I'll give you some artistic freedom there. I understand what you're trying to do.
Right.
That's cool. But yeah, the one panel here shows them resting on the bottom. So that's what they're doing. Now they've shut everything down. They've gone silent, trying to wait for everything to pass by, pass over, pass however near that they're going to be. At this particular point, Captain Wilhite decides that now is the best time to say that he doesn't agree with this plan.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, he does it to the extent that Captain Savage tells him that he needs to whisper. I don't care what is going on. This man is a captain, and the orders are for silence.
Mm-hmm.
Why in the world he would even be talking anywhere near a normal voice, much less raising his voice?
Exactly.
Okay?
Because he knows, even if he's mad and angry and frustrated and cannot stand Savage, he knows the importance of being quiet right now.
Well, you would think he does anyway.
Right.
But not only that, okay, but he is reprimanded by Savage. And in a huff, as he's leaving, he, what does he do? Like, accidentally kicks the bulkhead?
Yeah, that's exactly what it looks like.
It looks like here. And so then he's like, oh, oh, I'm sorry. I would never do that on purpose. You know, and it's like, tie him up. Put him in his room.
Exactly.
And just
lock the door and keep him there.
So now, you know, we have two or three things that have gone on here that could very well have given the sub away. A couple panels later, sure enough, we have a panel here of a Japanese destroyer who made like they were leaving, but the sonar man on the ship indicates to his captain that he hasn't heard anything else other than this sound from just a couple minutes earlier.
Yeah, like a thump or a bump or whatever.
Yeah, the sound being where Will Height kicked the bulkhead or the bottom of the door that he was going through or whatever he ended up kicking. So the Japanese destroyer commander, whatever his rank is here, decides that it's better safe than sorry. We'll go back to approximately where you feel that sound came from, and we'll just drop some depth charges just to make sure.
Sure.
Which I thought was kind of, you know, we haven't heard anything else but this one thing out here in the middle of the ocean.
Right.
But that's enough to turn back and depth charge just to make sure.
Right.
Okay.
Well, but you have to understand, this is evidently something that is large scale that they don't want the Americans to know about. So if there is even a remote chance that the Americans or British or whomever may have a sub out there, it's better to drop a bunch of depth charges, in hopes that they destroy or sink it, rather than, oh, but it was nothing, and then come to find out it was something, and the Americans know we're coming now.
That's exactly what they do. I think the word pepper would be a good description of what they do with these depth charges.
Yeah, it is.
The page is a three-panel page. Mm-hmm. The top is above is on the water surface.
Right.
We see the destroyer tossing the depth charges. The next panel is in the water column. We see six depth charges falling. And then the bottom panel is the submarine resting on the bottom of this portion of the ocean, with depth charges dropping and going off all around. So the sonar man did a dang good job.
He did. He was like, pretty sure this is where it's at. All right, drop them.
Yeah.
And look at
I think it was right here.
Exactly.
And from that one sound now,
yep.
It's not like, you know, oh, we're picking up, the
multiple
engine
feet.
Noise or
right.
Picking up voices. Or No. It's this one thing that he triangulated, and they were dropping depth charges just about on the periscope.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how close they were.
I mean, they, you know, initially that first salvo that you were talking about, it was on either side. I mean, it was like boom, 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 this side, boom, boom, the other side, you know? So it's like, wow, dude, you earned your yen.
No doubt. He has a job for life.
Wait, is it yen?
Yen. Yes. For Japanese.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The nips use yen.
Oh, dude.
Oh, man, I went there.
You did.
So, forgive me, folks. I say that in jest. In all honesty, I say that in jest. I don't have anything against my yellow brother. Or, the Japanese.
Well, our ratings just skyrocketed.
I have no problems. I have a Japanese friend. Right, is that the last? That's the last one, right?
Well,
there.
No, that's like, that's how you're supposed to. Never mind.
Okay. that's the correct answer. Well, no. I have a Japanese friend.
You don't understand. It's okay with him.
Oh, man. Yeah. You can't even joke like that nowadays. No. Everybody's so serious about stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because, you know, I can't stand it when I'm called white bread.
Oh, yeah, I guess not.
Because, you know, I'm a health nut. I want multigrain. Call me multigrain.
There you go, multigrain. Weedy.
Exactly. Shredded wheat.
There you go. You know? Okay, so we're on the sub here. They're being bracketed by depth charges. Savage is yelling out commands, basically just telling everybody to hunker down and hang on. He's not telling them to do anything new at this point. So they're down here hoping, you know, that there is nothing overly close to the submarine. Those of you who are old enough and have watched enough movies, you know kind of how this looks if you can see it in your mind's eye as far as this submarine being bombarded by these 55-gallon drum-looking things popping. The effects of the people in the sub perhaps being thrown around, perhaps things busting loose from the increases in pressure.
Actually,
that are not
one. I think one of the best explanations would be Star Trek. The original Star Trek. When they get hit by something, everybody on the inside of the bridge throws themselves. So if you can imagine an attack
in one direction.
Exactly. If you can imagine an attack on the Enterprise and how they're reacting and like the explosions and the random flame ups and the pieces of things coming down, that's what would be happening inside the sub.
Oh, okay. There is our ubiquitous Star Trek reference. So Captain Savage is like James T. Kirk because. So Savage comes up with this idea of loading the torpedo tubes with stuff and then firing that out to try to convince the attacking ship that the submarine has imploded, taken damage, perhaps even been destroyed, although I wouldn't think that you would – except that it's been destroyed until you saw bodies floating.
But yeah, I guess.
That's just me. I guess bodies float.
Well, I mean, there too many times, like, I've heard reports where it was like, you know, the sub was hit and went down and, you know, all crew members were lost, but yet there are no reports of anyone ever seeing, like, bodies. So I don't know how the mechanics work. But I wouldn't necessarily say, well, no bodies, we should keep bombing.
Right, yeah. After giving that command, the crew starts to act on that command, but then one of the lurches of the submarine throws Savage into the bulkhead and knocks him out.
It's because he wasn't in the captain's chair.
Yes, he wasn't secured.
That's what seat belts are for.
So
they'll save lives.
They do. So Wilhite takes this opportunity to reassert his command.
Yes.
And not only is he reasserting his command, but under his command, he is going to do what he thought should be done rather than submerging, waiting for the convoy to pass, and then moving on. His idea was kind of a twofold. We run or we hit and run.
Right.
One or the other, just depending on, you know, what presents itself. So now Wilhite is in command and he jumps in and issues the orders after all of the flotsam is ejected to load up torpedoes 1 and 2. And let's see, does he tell him to raise to periscope depth or just load the torpedoes right now. And then we're going to wait and see if after seeing all of this stuff that we ejected, if the boat leaves.
Right. And can I just interject that Wilhelm is really creepy? Because he just appears in the last panel of page 12, like, out of nowhere.
Yeah, that's true. He's there behind a couple sailors.
Yeah, it's just like, and shortly, I mean, very shortly after Savage is knocked out, boom, there's Wilhelm.
Yep, and he is supposed to not even be on the bridge.
That's it, yeah, that's my point. He's supposed to be in his quarters because that's where he was relegated to.
Yeah, that's where he was ordered to. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe with all the jostling of the ship, he thought, well, no, I'll go on the bridge. Who knows?
Yeah.
But, yeah, he's there. He takes command. Mm-hmm. He gives new orders now. So now they're waiting to see what the results of their ploy is here as far as how the Japanese ship takes it. So on the surface, the destroyer captain, I believe, is who's speaking. Yes, because he says, I'm not convinced our enemy has been destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a trick. Merely oil and debris fired through torpedo tubes. Now, to be certain, we will drop still another round of depth charges.
Now, see, this shows me that he's a seasoned captain. Because Savage mentioned when he was he didn't mention it. He was thinking it. When he ordered the tubes to be filled with stuff, he thought to himself, it's got to work. It worked before. And so this is a tactic that the honorable captain of the Japanese destroyer has seen. So the captain of the destroyer, seasoned captain.
True. Not so easily swayed.
No.
So he does indeed, or they do, the destroyer does indeed drop depth charges again. The ship, the submarine is, you know, rattled and thrown about. Wilhite commands that they will leave. They'll attack and leave. So the ship fires up engines, starts to go up or rise, or I'm not sure what the correct term is in the water column to attack this destroyer that they can't seem to shake. One of the other crewmen is trying to wake up Savage to the extent that even to get him to clear his head quickly enough, he slaps him.
Yeah, that was a funny scene.
That is kind of funny. Yeah, he says, please, Skipper, another few seconds and it'll be too late. Slap! Meanwhile, on the Japanese destroyer, the sonar man has heard everything now that the submarine is doing, recognizes what it's doing, relaying that to the captain. The captain giving further orders to prepare guns, continue to drop depth charges, you know, we'll be ready no matter what they do. So,
yeah, he even heard the slap.
Yeah,
he was like, I believe that's a slap.
Ooh, the captain is undergoing torture.
Exactly. It's like they seem to have a mutiny of some sort. Honorable captain, we should strike now.
Savage comes to. He jumps up and reprimands Wilhite, which I don't know. Perhaps he should reprimand the crew that is doing what Wilhite said rather than doing what Savage said.
Well, to be fair, Savage was completely unconscious.
Yeah, but don't you try to resuscitate the man?
And they were, but during that, I took it as he was the captain before, he's the captain now. They need someone to tell them what to do. They're going to do it. Other guy, he's out. Yeah, some people are trying to wake him up, but he's still out, so meh.
Okay, yeah. I mean, that was pretty much the sequence of events, certainly.
Yeah, and I'm not going to fault the crew. I mean, because the crew, they're basically trained to follow orders of a commanding officer. So,
right.
So when one falls and another one stands up, you do that.
Okay. All right. So there we have the situation now. Savage and Wilhite actually have a three or four panel bickering back and forth about who's in charge.
Yeah, they do.
And then it finishes with Savage physically accosting Wilhite and telling him that the only man on this ship who will face a hearing will be you, Captain, because the captain threatened the crewmen who did not follow him with court-martial.
Right.
And then Savage says, well, no, you know, they're going to do what I say, and you will be the one court-martialed. And he finishes, unless you return to your quarters immediately. And if you refuse, so help me, I'll drag you below personally. Do I make myself clear? Wilhite says, yes, sir.
And I believe him.
Oh, absolutely. At this point, the submarine has been continuing to surface. That was the last command given. So when Savage takes command of the boat, that is the situation that he has. The submarine is surfacing to, I guess to the very least, they're surfacing to torpedo depth.
Periscope level?
They would have to go to periscope depth in order to sight, I guess, to target the torpedo. And I don't know if torpedo and periscope are the same depth.
Because the periscope's
not very tall. So, I mean, you're going to have to be pretty shallow to.
Yeah, but you can shoot torpedoes without seeing.
True. Right. Yeah.
So then,
and you can shoot them at an upward angle, mm-hmm. as you know, again, as long as you know where you're targeting.
Right.
So.
As long as you've got a decent ping on your target, you can shoot.
So they're surfacing for one or the other or both.
Mm-hmm.
They do surface enough for the periscope. They get a sighting on the ship. They also find, and I'm sorry, I fail to note when this happened. Looking here, I can't pick it up quickly. But the rest of the convoy has left this lone destroyer to attend to whatever it's attending to.
It was right there.
Okay,
that was it. Just because it took me too. It was like, wait, what?
Yeah. So there, I you would think that the commander of the destroyer would have told the rest of the convoy what he's doing, and the convoy would have not stopped, but they would have sent some ships in support, you know, just to be sure. You have a problem. Well, here, let's make sure that we take care of this problem.
Hey, Ed.
No. Yeah.
I just lost you for a good 5 to 10 seconds.
Okay, it should be okay because I'm recording on my end, so.
Okay.
Okay, so we're surfaced. Levi, as you said, Savage has noted that the rest of the convoy has left, mm-hmm. so all they are having to deal with is this lone destroyer. They see that the destroyer is coming straight at where the periscope is, the destroyer having seen the periscope, and it is making directly for the periscope. We have several panels, basically, of a game of chicken. The destroyer bearing down on the periscope of the submarine. Savage watching through the periscope as the destroyer barrels down on them. The four torpedoes have been armed previously as per Wilhite's orders. When the destroyer gets within range, Savage gives the order for first one and then the second torpedo to be fired.
Mm-hmm.
He watches in the periscope as first one, then the second torpedo hit.
Yep.
Sinking the destroyer.
Yep.
They then decide that it's time to beat it. They
just beat it.
Yes. Get yourself an egg and beat it. Now, radio what they've done, where they're at, when they're shallow enough in the water, they dive down and head back to base. With Savage back able to bemoan his...
I was going to say once again, yeah.
Marital fate. Yep. Yeah, so he was distracted, but not for very long. And then, as you said, this story is dedicated to Submariners. The last drawn page of the book is a full page of a submarine in the water column with nice fishes and corals and whatever underneath. And from what little I know, a fairly accurate rendering of a World War II submarine here.
Right.
So, and that is the story with several letters pages here at the end and the 204 piece Revolutionary War soldier set for only $2.
Yeah, there you go.
And we finish up Captain Savage's tale.
It was a good tale.
It was different. I don't think I've ever read a war comic book that was on a submarine. So that was something different. Oh. I've seen plenty of movies.
No, there was again that. I think it was Nick Fury and the Raiders. They were on a sub to get to an island, but that was the extent. So like the entire thing wasn't on a sub.
Right. Yeah. It was transportation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
So yeah, this was pretty much entirely on a sub and pretty much new and different.
Yeah, and you know, you had all those the issues that you would have as far as trying to avoid detection and then being detected and trying to avoid being destroyed and then attacking and watching through the periscope and you know, all the typical memes or paradigms of what, at least what I have associated with Submariner work.
Right.
All those tropes, kicking the bulkhead accidentally, mm-hmm. making noise when you're not supposed to.
Yep.
You know, all of these things all wrapped up into one story.
Mm-hmm.
All right. What is your thumbs opinion of this story?
Well, I'm going to give it a thumbs up.
Okay.
I think my two biggest detractions were just the lamenting of Savage. over his family, not saying that one shouldn't, you know, lament the loss of his wife and children, loss though being the divorce and not death. And I can get how, you know, he is saddened by this very sudden disconnect. Just, you know, they're now not part of his life. Oh my God, what? So, okay, I get that, but the writers, I think, just overdid like the, I'm sorry, but it's a Silver Surfer, Spider-Man, like, woe is me sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, we have probably a 27, 28, 25, anywhere from 25 to 27 page comic book as far as the art, and a good 5 or 6, so probably a page to a page and a half of that mm-hmm. was just him lamenting.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just, you know, there were a number of panels that were just dedicated to the inner monologue.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, in the name of character development, it was a little bit too much as far as that's concerned.
So that's my one. My two or number two detraction from it is the young lieutenant and how absolutely just dumb he was.
Okay.
If you have command of a vessel, I expect more from you.
Yeah, I mean, he is in charge of whatever, 40, 50, 60 men, you know, the whole boat.
Yeah, exactly. So I expect more from someone who commands something as important, at least in my opinion, as a submarine.
Sure.
And as important as an intelligence gathering mission. Now, granted, he wasn't in charge, but he didn't know that when they were going on the mission.
Well, but he very easily, if Savage hadn't put in for other duty, could have been in charge of this mission.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was just that close to being, being the one responsible, but yet he showed definitely to be lacking in maturity.
Yeah.
And unable to take what I take to be a very typical military directive, and that is orders.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, here is somebody that we want to command this mission, and he gets all, you know, butthurt mm-hmm. over it.
Yeah, the audacity to say, you know what, I know that, you know, they put you in command, but
yeah.
Why don't we do this? Why don't I command and you just advise?
Now, given that, at least he did broach that subject just between the two of them.
Well, yes.
You know, rather than suggesting that out.
Yes.
So.
But still, it's just like, you know what, dude, shut up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're right. You're right. I'm just thinking, well, you know, he could have been worse.
Mm-hmm.
he could have brought that up on the bridge or something like that.
Or he could have tried to get the men on his side.
Yeah, there you go.
So
what do you think of this Savage guy, Gunny? So what do you think is good?
So yeah. You know that I am in command of the ship, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Could have.
Yeah.
But that is kind of a disappointment to me. There were no characters called Gunny.
Well, that's because Gunny's a more of a Marine term, gunnery sergeant.
Okay. I thought ships always have a gunny. Do they not?
Okay. I don't know. Again, this is my lack of military knowledge. So.
Yeah, I guess I've just been watching too much NCIS.
Probably. So. But, yeah, overall, thumbs up. Yeah.
Okay. I'll agree with your thumbs up assessment and give it one of my own. There's not really anything else that I would add to kind of the letdowns of the story from what you've already said.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that I enjoyed the art. There's something, and I didn't give any creator information, did I?
Oh, shame.
Let me look that book back up here. There's something about, to me, the style of art that really lends itself to World War II. And I'm not sure why. I would have to really sit and think about it. This was written by Stan Lee, or edited by Stan, let's see.
Edited by Stan Lee.
Yeah, it was edited by Stan. It was written by Gary Friedrich. Penciled by Dick Ayers, inked by John Severin, and lettered by Gene Izzo. So I am liking Dick Ayers' World War II rendering. It's clean, but it's not photorealistic clean. There is definite – you can definitely tell that it's been inked. And it's not been just colored mm-hmm. to indicate boundaries. I like that about it. But it's not I really appreciate in this type of setting the fact that it's not ultra detailed, but it is detailed more than enough for you to tell what all's going on.
And where they're at.
Yes. Yes. You know, there are scenes, like, say, on the submarine, mm-hmm. where there is stuff on the walls, like you would expect to be, mm-hmm. but Ayers didn't spend 90% of his time just filling in the walls.
Right.
You know, with actual dials and actual numbers and all this. It's like a circle, little circle for a knob. You know, yeah, just to,
shading.
To give you more than just the idea that it's there, mm-hmm. but it's like that's not what the panel was for. The panel was for what's in the foreground, which is usually people or faces, torsos, right. or, you know, something like that. So I like that mix of things. I definitely got a lot of kinetic in those panels that needed it. People moving, people emoting. Several panels have Savage sweating.
Yeah. Yeah, they do.
So, you know, and you can say, well, that's a lot of things. That's the pressure. That's perhaps him being out of his element now that he hasn't commanded for a while.
Right. And, you know, the heat of being stuck inside of a closed space where,
right.
where all the machinery is working and heating up and everything.
So there's, you know, there's to me, because of where you saw the perspiration on him, it could be for several different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Ayers, not Ayers, that's the artist. Will Hite also is shown several places perspiring.
Mm-hmm.
And perspiring for effect too. It, you know, like Savage, it's not just a general all the time kind of thing. Here in one panel in particular I like where the submarine is firing on the destroyer, it's three lines of panels,
mm-hmm.
and this is the middle panel on the middle line,
yep.
showing Savage looking through the periscope, again, with perspiration.
Mm-hmm.
But the panel prior to that is the destroyer captain, the Japanese destroyer captain,
mm-hmm.
who is also perspiring.
Yep.
Now, he appears to be out, which I'm not sure why necessarily, but both of these men are concerned about the situation, which was the seeming chicken thing between the two of them, the destroyer
right.
coming up on the sub. And so anything else aside, my impression right off the bat looking at those pictures is both of those men are concerned about that situation.
Right.
Nothing else, for no other reason that I would be aware of in the story. Looking at this page, seeing what's happening, and then seeing those two, here's two men facing each other, and they are both concerned about the outcome of that meeting. That's what I would get from that page.
Right.
So, you know, just little things like that. I really enjoyed about Decares' art on that. So, I definitely give it a thumbs up as well.
Mm-hmm.
The writing, some of the lingo, and I just a little off-putting. Didn't really take me out of the story.
Yeah.
But I just every now and then, you know, you'd be reading through page after page, and you'd read through that one balloon, and then you'd be like, "What?"
Yeah.
So, not too bad. And you know, forgiveness for the 70s.
Yeah.
Older men writing in the 70s. Yeah. You know, they're writing in the 70s, but these men may be 50, 60 years old at this time.
Exactly. So, I mean, you're looking at a totally different generation.
Yeah. I mean, you're conceivably almost the beginning of that century,
mm-hmm.
up to the 70s is the life experience of these men that are putting words to the paper.
Right.
So,
and still trying to make it okay enough to sell.
Well, hip and cool.
Yeah.
Because still, I think that the demographic that they're shooting for is still that teen, mm-hmm. you know, early adolescent teen kind of target. They're certainly not trying to get adults, I don't think, really to read the books. So, all right, guys, our second book, last book, final book, next book, whichever.
Why don't I say final? Because that makes it sound so final.
For the episode.
Oh, well, okay, that makes more sense.
And what are those words? Last, final, next? Are those adjectives?
They're words.
Yeah, but what kind of word? Adverbs? They're not adverbs.
Definitive.
They're adjectives, aren't they?
Definitive.
So, anyways, Captain America, issue 123 on the cover, says that Cap battles for his life against Nick Fury,
mm-hmm.
and the Mysterious Suprema. Now, the Mysterious Suprema, okay, that must be the bad guy, but, and Nick Fury? Come on, man. Nick is one of the good guys, and he's a good friend of Cap's. They've known each other since the war and all that stuff, so something's going on there. Cap is swinging up into the rafters, quote-unquote, of a building, evading Fury and a bunch of S.H.I.E.L.D. agents on one side of the cover, and who I would assume is Suprema. I'll also go out on a limb and say that's a female name, so the female here is the main bad and some of her minions or minionettes. And on the next page, Levi.
Minionettes. And there he is. See, now, I'm happy now.
Yes, we have the return of Arnold.
Yep. He's back.
Holding this young lady.
The same young lady that has been in just about every page with him.
Yeah, I guess it was just the one picture. I guess he just posed once, and they used it over and over in the Joe Weider, I guess you would pronounce it,
mm-hmm.
personal trainer book.
You know, it's funny. I look at her, and she almost looks like a young Cassie Lee Gifford.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Which
you say a Bloody Mary every time, huh? Yeah. Okay.
Seriously,
yeah.
She's got like the eyebrows and the nose of a young Kathy Lee Gifford.
Kathy Lee. Okay. Well, does that mean that this is Hoda in disguise?
Yes.
It looks just like. Oh, never mind. Mm. Okay. Yeah, that was too easy.
Mm-hmm.
So we open up with Suprema here talking to her. You liked the word minionettes.
Yes,
so.
I did.
Except they're all male, so I guess perhaps that would be a bit me showing genderism,
I guess. I thought it was, you know, a dance move.
A minuet?
Yeah.
A minionette. Yes. And the adventures of Suprema and the minionettes were brought to us by Stan Lee and Gene Colan, embellished by, what is that?
Sinote?
Not inked, but colored. Yeah, colored by Joe, I believe it's pronounced Sinote.
Sinote, okay.
Yeah. And lettered by Artie Simic. All names that we've heard in the Bronze Age.
She is the wife of Joe
Weider.
Betty.
Oh, in the ad? Terry just looked up the young lady in the ad, and she informs me that this is Joe's wife, Betty.
Really?
Go figure.
Wow.
I guess they spent all their money on paying Arnold.
Yeah, exactly.
They didn't have any more for the photo shoot, so he's like, Betty, come here.
Get my wife. She's a looker.
Yeah, she's in shape. She works out, too. That's very interesting. And if I may, what did you Google to find that out?
I was just going to ask, how in the world did you find out who that was?
Arnold Schwarzenegger is holding in comic book ads.
Okay.
Yes, just straight English. I mean, that's just...
There you go.
Because somewhere, somebody posted that exact question. And, yeah... So, okay. Well, that's interesting. So that's Joe's wife, Betty. Joe has the system and Betty does marketing.
There you go.
Marketing and PR. And Arnold is just a pretty face. Or body, I guess, given what Joe does.
I was going to say, you're looking at his face? Okay.
Yeah. Did it say, was there any connection between Arnold and Joe? I wonder if he trained Arnold during those Mr. Universe years or Mr. Atlas or whichever one of those he won. Well, that's cool. Betty and Joe and Arnold. Okay, now we know. So, Suprema is talking to her minions, explaining that they are moving in on all of the, as she puts it, big-time rackets, gambling combines, and shakedown operations.
Yeah, I liked that she said all of the big-time ones.
So, okay. In the city, I guess you just assume that they're in New York, I guess. I mean, in whatever area they're in. Some of the men have some doubts. They think that perhaps they're expanding too much too quickly, and they're not going to have the manpower or the muscle to do it. But Suprema assuages their fears in saying that she has the one power that can do it, the power of witchcraft. The power to make men obey my every command.
And I'm the one with the Bloody Marys. Okay.
And yeah, maybe I need it. That's the problem there. I'm drying out here. Mm-hmm. So, witchcraft. She can compel men. And most importantly, they also have at their disposal the Wolverine jet.
Yeah, that was good, too. That was good.
It just sounds bad. You know, yes, the Wolverine jet. And when it first appears, it just looks like you can see the jets on it. Okay. Mm-hmm. It looks like a large multi-axle truck with jets attached to the upper front corners mm-hmm. of the box hauling portion of the truck, if you guys out there can picture that. So that is the Wolverine jet, but it's a truck. So they take off on their latest sortie, shall we say, to combine all the crime under one leadership here in the area. They get to a place where a meeting – oh, no, it's not a place, is it? It's a
it's a casino. A casino.
Yeah, one guy here calls it Aces Wild.
Yeah.
So it looks like it's a house. So it's apparently some sort of illegal gambling establishment. Can't really tell if it's regular or if it's just expensive, you know, men with money or mm-hmm. what the level is. It's just a casino of some sort. She goes to the gentleman overseeing it and tells him that she is there to take over. And as he indicates to his men to take out the trash, as it were, she again tells him what he's going to do. And this time he acquiesces and agrees that he will give over his operation to her.
Right. It's, you know, it's one of those, but do you really? No, I guess I don't.
Yeah, I noticed in the entire book that every time it took twice.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like once was the suggestion and the second was the command. Right? You know, she phrased it almost exactly the same way mm-hmm. each time when she does. So I guess it takes her power a little bit to work, and then she checks on her power.
Right. It's like these aren't the droids you're looking for. Yes, they are. Are they really? No.
Oh, you're right. No, they're not. Yeah, that's exactly. See, it would have been much better if it had gone like that.
Right.
You know, just a wave of her hand.
Yeah, exactly.
But no, she has to ask again.
And then she's got, you know, like this little lightning bolt sparkle thing in her eye, like, you know, is it really?
Yeah, in this panel, does that come up in future?
Not that I noticed.
Usages of her power.
Not that I noticed.
Yeah, I didn't think I noticed either. But yeah, here it's pretty obvious that that's what Gene Colan did. He showed that she is using some sort of whammy on him here,
and must also be evil.
Yeah, with her pinky up at the corner of her mouth.
Exactly.
So she walks off with him as they work out the particulars of her taking control.
And go to excuse me. This is what I loved about this one. Go to sign a contract.
Yes. With that way he can never back out of
exactly, it. Exactly, because you know, a contract is legally binding for those who do illegal things.
Right. There are no outs. Right. No take backs.
Right.
If you sign a contract.
So they're going to go sign the contract to seal the deal on their illegal activity.
And yes, indeed. And apparently it's been working for her because that's how she's been doing it.
Yeah.
We get back to the Wolverine and they move on.
The Wolverine jet. Just so
Wolverine
just,
jet.
Yeah,
yes.
Just so we're clear.
Yes. They move on to their next place, which looks to be a bookies establishment. I believe I see a board there in the back. They come in and a gentleman is on the phone. Once again, she tells what she's going to do. The person that she's trying to control refuses, and then she simply states it again, and they acquiesce. So we have a panel here of just here it is again, Levi in her eyes.
Yep.
See, I guess I didn't notice
this. I didn't either. And as soon as we went to this panel, after mentioning it last time, I was like, oh, look, there it is again. But only this time it's in both eyes.
Yeah, but it's I think it's showing multiple times, though, because of what's above the eyes,
mm-hmm.
The different people.
Right.
Basically, we get the impression from the next several panels of her and her crew doing it repeatedly as she's gaining control of the underworld in this area. She even plies her witchcraft on a police officer that stops them. Given how weird the truck looks, I can understand why they would have stopped them. But Right. They make it look as if they're stopped because of speeding. Either way, she, I guess just to reaffirm to us how able she is to do this, she can even convince police officers that she is in the right. So that's like the final, wow, she can do anything.
Yep, if you can convince a cop.
Yeah, yep. Next up, we hit the barbershop because inside the barbershop, which is just a front, is a training facility for SHIELD agents.
Yes.
Where we find Cap and Sergeant Fury sparring. There's the word I'm looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Sparring, and also Cap is using the opportunity to teach the recruits that are watching he and Fury spar as he's calling out commands for the recruits to watch in particular.
Right.
You know, this move, watch as I do this move. What this one panel, the last panel on the page, he says, notice how the right hip is used to gain maximum leverage and sudden thrust. And the way he's bending Fury over, I'm not sure that his right hip was really all that useful.
No, not really, because he's actually more close to the head and the bending back of that neck than actually trying to leverage his hip into flipping.
Yeah, that's what I thought when I was, you know, reading it first. I'm like, okay, he's gonna show some sort of judo toss or something like that. But when I looked at the drawing, I was like, no.
No, that hip is meant for breaking that neck.
Yeah, so he takes it to Fury pretty well, and they finish up. They have a little tete-a-tete here, going back and forth about practicing together. Nick Fury talking about how difficult and how aggressive Cap is, even though he's just training. Cap wanders off to, who knows, go get cleaned up, maybe catch a shower or something like that after sparring. And as he does, his inner monologue is talking about his desire to marry a particular girl, but that he doesn't see how it would work with her being as committed to her job in S.H.I.E.L.D. as she is, and he being as committed to being Captain America as he is.
Right, and it was funny because I was like, oh, yeah, she, you know, she's all about her job. Cap needs a woman who needs to stay home and cook.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's what he would prefer. I don't know, but
because it was so like, you know, wait, so like this chick is dedicated to her job, like you are, and that's bad. Okay, no, just don't get her pregnant and keep shoes on her, and she'll be fine.
I guess, yeah. Hard to say exactly what they were going for there. Could be something very, you know, traditional. Could be just something about, well, we just won't have time for each other.
Well, I mean, I could see that, but I mean, wouldn't you make time on, you know, downtime for missions? You know, you're Cap and you're doing a mission, and you're Chica and you're doing a mission, and now neither of you are doing a mission, so you make the most of that?
Well, yeah, you would think that would be the... Especially having gone through wartime, I'm sure that's exactly what leaves were like.
Right.
You know, you just did your best to put it behind you for 48 hours, mm-hmm. and made the best of those 48 hours, and then you
went back
at it,
yeah,
after 48 hours. So, yeah. Yeah, it's, I guess it's just my thinking would be they're trying to more humanize him, you know, give him some real world, some Spider-Man problems.
Or Silver Surfer problems, or...
Yeah. You know, instead of Captain America, the unkillable super soldier from World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. Yeah, they're trying to street level, you know, humanize him a little bit. Next, we are at Suprema's heavily fortified headquarters.
Well, of course, because if it were not heavily, you know, it would have been infiltrated.
Right, exactly. This is how serious she is.
Heavily serious.
So she is again talking to her men, probably the upper echelon of men, to be more specific. And she always has a gentleman with her, and she has named him a couple times. Let me.
It starts with an O, but I can't remember it. Hold on.
Scarbo.
Okay, so it doesn't start with an O at all.
Wasn't that what it was? Scarbo?
Yeah.
S-C-A-R-B-O, yeah. Scarbo. So it's Suprema and Scarbo. He almost looks more like, say, a bodyguard to her.
Yeah.
And rather than like a flunky or an underling.
And has acted like it so far, or at least a number one.
Yeah, yeah, a definite number one.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Because so, in the opening scenes – he was basically the one that was, you know, like, you know, be quiet, shut up. Suprema is talking.
You know? Right, right, yeah.
So
they, she is talking to the other men with Scarbo here, but you kind of assume from his posture that he knows this. She's continuing to lay out the plan. They finished with all this penny any crime takeover kind of stuff, and now we're going to take over S.H.I.E.L.D. itself.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, the men question that, you know, do they really have the power to do that? She proceeds to explain on the trip to infiltrate S.H.I.E.L.D. how they're going to do it. So they take the Wolverine jet, of course.
Yeah, the truck.
Yes. And she has found out that each of the S.H.I.E.L.D. agents has a special identifying mini badge that emits a signal of some sort that, using an ultra-sensitive electro scanner, she or they, Suprema's men, will be able to pinpoint from a distance of no more than 500 yards. So from 500 yards closer, they'll be able to pick up the signal given off from this mini badge, and so then identify an agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., follow them to a secret hideout. Not one in particular.
Right. You
know, not the base or a weapons cache, or just we need a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent and they will lead us to a S.H.I.E.L.D. place. And it works. And unfortunately, the stooge that they find is Dum Dum Dugan. I was kind of disappointed by that. But
I wasn't.
You know, I mean, he's not thinking. No S.H.I.E.L.D. agent would be thinking about being picked up that way, or they would not have that type of device on them.
Right.
So, okay. So she, they pull up next to Dugan in the truck, and she whammies him with her witchcraft, and asks for the location of Sergeant Fury. So now we see that she wasn't just looking for a place. She wanted to find an agent so they could take her directly to the director of S.H.I.E.L.D., Nick Fury himself.
Right.
That's pretty high targeting there.
Yeah, it is. And it works uncharacteristically well.
Yeah, it worked. He Dum Dum told her where Nick was, not only told her, but led her there.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Captain America happens to be there. Looks like the S.H.I.E.L.D. agents are at a weapons testing grounds. It's an open air area outside of town.
Yep, they're testing out some of Stark's latest weapons.
So they notice that Dum Dum is there and has brought a female, and she, of course, walks up and starts talking to Nick. While she is, Cap notices that something is off. Something just doesn't feel right. He notices that other S.H.I.E.L.D. agents are starting to get in on – not get in, but they're starting to pay attention to the conversation she's having with Fury.
Get on board.
Which, as we know, probably means that she is casting her spell on them as well as Fury all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
That was my assumption, yeah. Anyways, when I read it. Cap becomes distracted by a weapon that is fired at him that ricochets off his S.H.I.E.L.D. He then turns and sees that Suprema and Scarbo are talking to him, and Scarbo attacks. Cap fights him off, is then beset upon by other members of Suprema's entourage, the, you know, I don't, numbers 3 through 8, or,
right.
You know, however it's determined. Cap quickly, or not quickly, but convincingly, fends them off. Then we get a page of multiple panels, 2, 4, 5 panels here. And at the top, the narration says, "If you can dream up any copy for this page good enough to embellish Gene's dazzling artwork, be my guest. I pass. Stan."
Yeah.
So I would assume that copy is text.
Mm-hmm.
Or sound effects. It could be either people speaking or the sound effects. And Stan just thought this Gene Colan artwork was too good to blemish with word balloons.
Yeah, because it didn't need, you know, like bam, pow.
Right. Now, I can't say that I disagree. I like the artwork here. It's very dynamic, very kinetic, lots of energy, lots of motion. You have gunshots and ricochets and one of the bad guys being hit by Cap's shield. Cap physically engaging several members. So, I mean, you have everything in those five panels that I think Captain America does.
Well, but here's my thing. These five panels, I have seen this action before, and it has had, like, the inner monologue or the, you know, the action bubbles or the sound bubbles.
Right.
And so that's why that was – because I looked at it, and I looked at it for a while, and I'm like, okay, what am I missing? Because I've seen, like, action scenes like this before, mm-hmm. and I'm not seeing, like, you know, that this isn't, for me at least, it wasn't, like, super, super, oh, my God, this is amazing. So it threw me a little bit.
Maybe things were kind of tight that week, and they wanted to cut a page off of the letterer's check.
Okay.
For the book, you know. So they said, here you go, Artie. Go ahead and letter 23 of the 24 pages.
Right.
You know? So Artie got a page of Iron Man that week to fill out his regular book quota or something.
Right.
Who knows? Eventually, Cap becomes surrounded. Let's see. He determines that the better part of valor is to jump into the truck. to drive the truck off, I would assume. It doesn't look like he jumped in it to, like, you know, go through the truck and come out the other side or anything cool like that. He jumps in it, grabs the wheel, hits the starter, which is a button, by the way, and starts up the truck. Uses it to escape the fight.
Now, see, that's what I thought was funny.
Yeah, yeah. He was outnumbered, yes, but not, like, severely or by, you know, a bunch of giants or, you know, mm-hmm. something that you would be like, well, you know, yeah, maybe Cap needs to think this through.
Well, I mean, I thought it was funny that he used their vehicle, the Wolverine jet truck, to get away from them.
Okay, yeah.
But then also we find out later he was so quick to rearward advance for a reason.
Yes,
which makes this sequence more understandable.
Right. Once you get to the end of the story, you're like, oh, okay. But, and I don't recall seeing it so far, and it has to have occurred by this point. Did you see him make a reference, like maybe when Suprema first showed up at the weapons testing range, about picking up some sort of vibration
nope.
in his shield?
No. Nope.
Or... And the shield. I mean, he had a feeling,
and he was stuck on a feeling.
Right, and that just could be, you know, superhero or soldier's intuition.
Right, I think he had a shield sense.
Well, you know, something comes up later on, and I was like, "Where did that happen?"
Yeah, inconsistency.
So, well. But it was consistent in the writer's head.
Yeah, that's what counts.
he knew the whole time.
Right,
so, I mean,
exactly.
You know. So Cap skedaddles in the Wolverine
jet truck
going to the morgue room of the city's biggest paper. That being the Spider-Man is the Daily Bugle.
Yeah, Daily Bugle.
Okay, and I say that because Daily Planet was running through my head, and I'm like, no, that's not him.
No.
That's somebody else.
Yeah.
So, Daily Bugle. So, we have a cameo by J. Jonah. in one panel here. Then Cap scoots on over to one of Tony Stark's factories, one in which Tony Stark himself happens to be working in. So we have a Tony Stark cameo.
Right.
Cap has gathered information from the paper, then uses one of Stark's computers to collate, I guess, that information to finalize the conclusion that he kind of had an inkling of about Suprema and Scarbo. He then jumps in the truck, heads to, let's see, is it Suprema's place?
No, I thought it was back to the training facility.
Then, as the speeding truck reaches its destination, is what it says on that panel, does he say newspaper files, Stark's computer, I know the secret of Suprema's power? So he doesn't say where.
I don't know.
Because there's a scene here of the truck crashing, but all the S.H.I.E.L.D. agents and everybody appear to be inside somewhere.
Yeah.
Like some sort of building or something. But Cap gets there, and as Suprema notices on her monitors that Cap is near and or there, the S.H.I.E.L.D. agents start to come to their right mind. They start to throw off her witchcraft.
Mm-hmm.
And so the S.H.I.E.L.D. agents, now of their right mind, attack Suprema's men. And we see from Cap here that he was using the truck to generate an electric current, and that electric current short-circuited Suprema's control.
Of witchcraft?
Apparently it wasn't witchcraft. It was some sort of perhaps mutant hypnotism or mechanical hypnotism, something like that. We see Scarbo exclaim that something is disrupting the control disc, so I guess that makes her power mechanically inclined.
Yeah.
So Scarbo and Suprema realize what's going on and head outside of the I believe this is her lair, to confront Captain America directly. They lose that battle rather spectacularly. Captain America informs us that he guessed that Scarbo and Suprema were ex-performers who parlayed a simple hypnotism act into a crime spree.
Yep.
And he determined this by searching old newspaper files and found some that showed business ads of Scarbo and Sister, Hypnotists Supreme.
Yep, he just had that thought.
And a piece of decoration that Scarbo had apparently was the electronic disc that was used to amplify the power,
mm-hmm.
Thus, I guess, allowing them to hypnotize multiple people at a time. And as Cap walks off, Suprema is screaming about how Cap should join her and that the two together will have power. And she says it 3 or 4 times each in bigger font as she's screaming it.
Right.
And Cap responds quietly as he's walking away, power. The evil men have done in its name.
And he would know.
Oh, he fought, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the day, and someone that has popped up in different forms since then, he definitely has an arch nemesis that is renowned for desiring power.
Yep.
And thus ends Captain America issue 123.
Yes.
So, Levi, what kind of thumb do you give that one?
I'm going to give it a thumbs up, but I'm going to give it like a tentative thumbs up. There were a few discrepancies that we discussed in it. And the ending is like that last panel is just, I don't know, anticlimactic.
Well, it almost looked like he was walking away defeated.
Yeah, like, I don't know. I mean, he won the day. He figured it out somehow. He got ideas that we didn't even know about. He did research that we didn't see. And he won the day. But then, you know, it's like, I mean, he's holding his head down. His shoulders are almost slumped. I mean, his arms are at his side, and he's walking away, like you said, almost looking defeated. And I'm guessing it's just he's remembering, like, all of the stuff that he's had to deal with, you know, with people that were in search of power and the things that they would do, you know, for it. But it was just such a disappointing end because of how he looked.
Okay. I certainly agree with everything you've said. That's you know, you're building and you know, the good guy figures it out and the good guy perseveres and wins in the end, and all of the unfortunate people under her power snap out of it, so they're all okay. And I mean, everything ends the way that it should, mm-hmm. to the good of the hero. Mm-hmm. But yet that last panel, you're like, dog, come on. You know, it's like the moral or the physical battle, but no moral victory, or, you know, something. Yeah. And I'm like,
I mean,
I missed maybe something somewhere.
maybe they're just trying to show his disappointment in, you know, once again, you know, someone is in search of. And he's, you know, he's doing that whole shaking the head thing from experience kind of thing.
That could very well be. Yeah, he's just done it so many times and here yet again as some
poor
schlub wanting power.
Yeah.
Yeah, it could be. It's kind of it leaves an interesting taste after reading the book.
Yeah, it does. I mean, yeah, honestly, I mean, I was like, yeah, okay, that happened, and how did he get that? Okay, but he's winning, and oh, okay, that's what happened. That's how they did it. And seriously, you get to that last panel, and it's like, oh.
And what I referred to is that apparently Cap felt some sort of vibration in his shield the first time that he met Suprema and Scarbo, that indicated to him something was up. That was the start of the fishiness.
Right. That's why he went to search out what he did at the newspaper, which he says in his conclusion. But there was absolutely no mention of it or no showing of it. There wasn't even a vibration in the shield, like, when it's not being hit. Like, you know, you would think, like, they would have a panel where he's just standing there and, like, there's a vibration in the shield. And then they would allude to, well, but I felt it. There wasn't even
that. Right. Yeah. It's... and I, you know, I don't know, was the story rushed at the time? You know, they had to get it out quick or what? But yeah, there seemed to be some logic gaps here and there.
Yeah, there were definite discrepancies.
So, because of that, Suprema and Scarbo are not, I don't think, Cap worthy villains. I'm going to give this one a thumbs down.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You know, it's cool to see a little piece of Cap's history, you know, but I think in the long run, this is going to be a piece of history that is quickly forgotten. So.
Well, I mean, not for the SHIELD agents.
Well, they already forgot it.
They're going to learn from it.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, I was very meh. Mm. So that gives us two thumbs up for Captain Savage, number 19, and Levi a thumbs up and me a thumbs down for Captain America 123.
Yep.
Now, next time, we have scheduled Daredevil issue 62 and Fantastic Four issue 96.
Now, you know what's funny? I said that, or rather you said that, you know, this is going to be one of those instances that is easily forgotten for Captain America.
I think, yes, his fighting of Suprema and Scarbo, yes.
Well, then I think probably this would be a very ephemeral encounter for Captain America.
I think in the long run, yes, it probably will be. Now, I could be wrong. There's hundreds more issues of Cap to come up, but I think, yes, this particular encounter will prove to be ephemeral.
There you go.
And having dropped ephemeral in the conversation, folks, that is our word of the show, as was suggested to us by Mick Knorr on Twitter. For those of you that listen that want to follow Mick Knorr, that's his Twitter handle. So thank you, Mick, for supplying the word of the show, ephemeral. I hope we used it to your liking.
And Mick, I just want to say, can't you do better than that, dude? I mean, come on.
Well,
Here's my glove. I take it off.
Oh, no. Oh,
I take it off. I have it in my hand and smack, throw down.
Oh, and he threw it down. Well, so there we have it. Yeah, next he's going to give us next week anti-disestablishmentarianism.
Well, let's hear Daredevil and what?
Fantastic Four.
Fantastic Four. That'll be simple.
All right, guys, if you want to give us a word of the show, or if you want to participate in the phrase that pays, as it were.
Phrase that pays. Now, concerning the phrase that pays, we do not have a new one this episode. That being because I have been on vacation between episodes, and in all honesty, I was literally in a cabin in the woods, and I was taking pictures of bears and snakes.
Yes, oh my.
I really was. So I failed in that. So we're going to continue until next episode. The phrase that pays, the mystery quote. I'll say it again, and this will be the last time. So here we go. All I want is a soft bed, an interrupted shut-eye. Nothing more.
There we go. Now, to tell us where that came from, who said it, and what book or group of books it came from, if that concept applies, you can send us that via email to themarvelbronzeage@gmail.com. You can tweet it to us at Marvel Bronze Age on Twitter. The Marvel Bronze Age has Facebook and Google Plus pages on which you can leave comments, so you can leave the information thusly.
There we go.
And the website, if you want to leave a comment for the show, you can go to bigtimenoise.com/Marvel Bronze Age. Now, I went through today and submitted information to have us show up on Twitter and Twitter on iTunes and Stitcher. So hopefully here within the next week or so, those will both go through. I don't see any reason why they would reject our our feed or anything. Right. So hopefully the next time we record, we'll be able to tell you that we're on iTunes and Stitcher and perhaps a couple others if I can get those organized and sent in as well. So that is coming up. Now, you do have the option of going to the website, bigtimenoise.com/Marvel Bronze Age, grabbing the RSS feed there and manually putting it into iTunes if you want to download using iTunes, or any other software-based RSS feed that allows manual input. So that is your current option. Or actually, you could go to the page, and if you have an RSS player that grabs feeds, it'll grab ours automatically also. So hopefully soon, though, we'll be on iTunes to make it a little bit simpler for everybody.
Yes.
And as I said, Daredevil and Fantastic Four next time, Daredevil 62, Fantastic Four 96. Other than that, I suppose we will just have to wait and talk to you next time, guys.
Yes, yes, yes. Unless you talk to us first.
No, I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
So, with that said, we'll see you guys then.
Peace.
The Marvel Bronze Age podcast is a Teal production, and as such is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Non-Derivatives 3.0 Unported license. The song Super Freaks is provided and performed by the Hammerheads.